welcome to another episode of Indie Darlings, a show where we discuss films that we consider to be indie darlings. And an indie film can be an indie darling for good or bad reasons, and it all depends on the film. Today's guest is the wonderful Dan Ammerman, an actor, comedian, improviser, and now glasses wearer.
It's true.
Dan, you chose the film You, the Living, a 2007 Swedish film, for the theme of taboo. Why did you do that, Dan?
Okay, it's a really good question, Connie, because I sort of was thinking about this movie a lot recently, and you gave me a couple different theme options. And I started thinking about this movie as taboo as the type of thing that people don't often put on screen.
Okay.
And I think there are a couple things in this movie that people don't often put on screen. I think one of them is just like the intensity of the nihilism of it, of just like things are very pointless in the movie, even if people seem to be kind of like trying to keep the relationship together, or they're trying to have a relationship with their parent, everything just seems to fall apart. And then I also think just even talking about death in the way that this movie talks about death, I think is another thing. People are seem to be in a constant state of decay. And if they're not dying, they are almost like zombies. They're like living dead, sort of, which even in the way that I'm sure we'll talk about, like, the makeup and like there's all these different aspects of this movie that just make everyone look like they're basically dead while they're alive.
Yes.
And so I was sort of just thinking, like, that's kind of like, you don't see risks like that being taken often in movies.
That is so funny. So you chose this because you felt the film was philosophically taboo, which is so adorable, but also so fitting for this film. Okay. The synopsis of this is kind of hard to say. It's a series of vignettes, 50 vignettes approximately, and the title of the film. It's mainly, I wish I'd done research before I saw the film instead of after, because I just kind of went into it blindly. But it's based on the poetry of the German writer, please don't butcher his name, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
And I kept pronouncing it as Goethe until I literally like just Googled how to pronounce it.
I looked it up before I came here too.
Yeah, it's
Goethe. Like,
Goethe.
Yeah.
And he's a famous German writer, and he is classified as not romanticism, but the thing that came after it, which I want to say, is it neoclassicism? I'm not sure, but it's like a critique of romanticism. And so this is based on a series of poems of his called the Roman
Elegies,
which is 20 poems about his time when he visited Rome. He's a fascinating character because he went to Rome looking for romance. And when he's there, he's like, basically what happened is like, he's like, none of this means anything to me. I don't know what any of this is. And it's the most Larry David response to Rome, which made me laugh. And knowing that, I'm like, oh, now I get this film.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a series of moments about the absurdity, but also the grandeur of life.
Mm-hmm.
And, if for those of you who have not seen this, the film doesn't really have a straight narrative. It is literally a series of vignettes, sometimes interweaving, not always. Some of these characters we get back to. A lot of them, it's literally just a moment. I foolishly tried to write down every single series, and it's literally 3 pages long. One of them is just, it says man in elevator.
Oh, it's a great moment.
Yeah. And, one weird thing about this is, for some reason, cause the cover art for this movie is very, it's kind of, in my opinion, dismal looking. And, I thought this was going to be a very dark and sad movie. I did not know it was going to be a comedy.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that I like with this movie the most. So Roy Anderson, the filmmaker, mm-hmm. he started his career doing commercials. Like, he was like a commercial director.
I could see that.
Yeah, and because he kind of had this, you know, a lot of commercials, they have to be like short, sweet, very pithy and mm-hmm. funny in order to just attract attention.
Yeah, he's definitely good at establishing a moment.
Yeah, yeah. And he brings that to this. He's at this point, he's like older. He's like either in his 70s or 80s.
Yeah.
And so this movie is one of a series of three movies that are done in this style. And they all have like an incredible balance of dealing with really dramatic and really kind of sad. Like, they deal with a lot of sadness and a yeah. lot of like intense ideas, mm-hmm. but in a way that's really funny. And mm-hmm. they're really funny movies. These movies are really hard to track down. Like, you can't even rent it like on iTunes or
yeah,
anything like that.
Yeah.
But if you can ever watch it with an audience,
yeah.
it plays so well because they're
really?
So funny.
Oh, wow.
I saw it once at New Beverly
uh-huh.
and it's hilarious, but it's almost like that thing where, you know, like a spoonful of sugar makes or helps the medicine go down, where
yeah.
it's like the comedy of it allows you to kind of have an in into the movie
yeah.
in order to then be able to kind of dish out the more philosophical stuff.
Also the music choice.
Yeah.
There
like,
is,
fum, 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 fum,
there's a,
fum, fum.
A very prominent
very Larry David
tuba.
Too.
Yeah.
yeah. Same as like her enthusiasm theme.
Yeah. It's a Dixieland style jazz band that's plays throughout the film. And, I was reading about it, and apparently the director was saying, there's something fascinating to me about 1930s music, you know, when the Nazis were coming to power. And I was like, well, that's really morbid, but weirdly funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it does provide a weird sense of levity and absurdness to the film, which is highly contrasted to the way it's shot. The way it's shot, when I was watching, it's the color palette is everything looks very drab. The lighting's very harsh. Everyone looks like they're having the worst day of their life.
They put everyone in this almost like white face. Like,
yes.
They make everyone, they do all their makeup incredibly powdered up. So mm-hmm. no one looks
good.
Like a real person, sort of. It's like everyone looks like kind of a ghost.
Yeah, like everyone looks like they just escaped a building that collapsed.
yeah.
Like, I actually Googled, what does Sweden look like? Because I was like, I know Sweden, like, they don't get much sunlight, but does it look like this?
Well, all of the movie are done on sound stages and sets.
That's so crazy. Yeah. All except one scene was shot in a studio. And I was like, I thought this was like in, where's that area that has, in Germany where it has those radioactive pigs?
Are you talking about Chernobyl?
Yeah,
or
it looks like it was shot in Chernobyl. And I was like, Sweden doesn't look like this.
So I think that he's going after this intentionally sort of flat look. So just mm-hmm. like everyone doesn't look bright and shiny,
yeah.
so does the world not look bright and shiny.
Yeah.
So he builds all these sets that look like sets.
Yeah.
So it has this sort of like German expressionist sort of thing mm-hmm. where everything is like overtly not real looking.
Yeah. It made me immediately think of, have you heard of this film called The Tribe?
No.
It's a film that takes place in the Ukraine, and it's about a school for kids that are deaf, but they also have a gang, and the entire film is in sign language with no subtitles.
Oh, cool.
And it's very intense. It's very violent, very dark, but it's also, when you watch it, you clearly like, oh, we are in a country that is not doing well.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think of that. But that's the Ukraine, and that's like the ghettos of the Ukraine, not Sweden, a country that is not really struggling, at least not compared to the Ukraine.
Well, I think that also the kind of like the fakeness of the way the sets look,
mm-hmm.
it also has to do the way that they actually shoot it.
Yeah.
It's a lot of just like a camera
uh-huh.
still in place.
Yeah.
Almost like they're shooting theater, like,
yeah.
like a proscenium type of situation.
Yeah.
And so you'll have the main action happening in the foreground, mm-hmm. but then you'll realize that it's in what's called deep focus, which means that like the entire frame, even way into the distance, is still in focus, which is kind of unusual in movies. And some other secondary joke will be happening like through a door frame, like way in the distance, or like outside of a window. There'll be some whole other thing happening. And so they needed to build these sets in order to have this kind of control over the environment, and also just make it feel so static. But another thing that's really interesting about the way that he shoots these is that he'll plan out these bits, or these kind of like, they're almost like little sketches. He plans out the sketch, he'll line it up, he'll shoot it, he'll do everything. Then he'll go away for like a month or two and just watch it, watch all the takes and figure out like what isn't exactly to his specifications. And then he'll go like rebuild the scene and shoot it again. So, and he can do that sort of because a lot of these things are just one shot. So, so he's like this ultra perfectionist and will just bring everyone back in to just redo these bits over and over.
Well, I read something online. I don't know if this is true only because I don't believe it. All of these were shot in one take.
I don't know. I mean, it's possible. He's a little bit, Roy Anderson in my mind is a little bit like Daniel Day-Lewis, where there's like, he's so kind of out there that there's almost like a mythology created around him.
I was like, there's no way everything was shot in one take.
Well, maybe what they meant by that is just like that they didn't cut in between things. Like there's that amazing scene on the train. Where like that's clearly happening like in one go. And you're just like, how is this? How is this possible that this is happening in one shot?
Yeah, and there's also this insane scene where this guy's, he pulls a tablecloth. He's trying to do the tablecloth trick, but it's on a really long, really ornate table. And at right before he's about to do it, everyone's like, can we eat first before you do this? And someone else is like, you know, one of those dishes is over 200 years old. And he's like, I got it. And of course, it ends disastrously. And
before he even does that, though, he's like in a truck, like explaining basically that he had this dream where this thing happened. And he explains from top to bottom exactly what you're about to watch. And then it cuts to the scene to be able to see that, which is an amazing, just comedically, to just explain everything you're going to see. You know exactly what's going to happen. But the tension of when he's going to pull the tablecloth is incredible.
Well, because there's all these little, like the way he describes it is very charming, but watching it also still felt surprising. Because the way he describes it, he's in a car that's in like really bad traffic, so slow that he's literally staring at you from his car as this car slowly moving away. And he's saying, I had a dream that I was at a family reunion where I didn't know anyone, but I felt some, like something bad had happened. I don't know what, but I felt guilty that it was my, I must be the one to add levity to the mood. And I was just like, this is, I love this person. And then you see him do it, and it's just, he, his idea to add levity to the mood is to do the tablecloth trick. And what happens afterwards is he gets sentenced to prison
by a bunch of judges who are all like drinking beer from steins.
Like there's three judges, and someone randomly comes out and serves them huge steins of beer. And yeah, so it has this wonderful surreal element.
He's sentenced to like life. He's sentenced essentially to die, right? Yes. Because of this thing. And then he's even, I think he says something like, everyone said it was the worst thing you could possibly do. Like, it's just one of these things where even like small transgressions are treated like life or death. And then he's sentenced, you see him get sentenced to death. Like, he's in the electric chair, but then the electric chair doesn't work. So even in like the darkest moments, they're still treated like sketches.
It was, and then the way the electric chair was shot was so surreal. Did it seem like the scale of it was off?
Kind of, everything, there's the, I think part of it is that proscenium thing that we were talking about, where everything in the distance is in focus, and things in the foreground are in focus. So you have to, normal movies will use editing and cutting in order to direct your eye, but he uses blocking instead. So like if he wants your eye to be in the top left of the screen, he'll mm-hmm. have someone move in that area. So you start looking there as opposed to cutting there.
Yeah.
And another way that he does that is with color. Like uh-huh. there's this woman that kind of recurs throughout the movie who wears these like purple boots.
Yes.
And there are times when she's in like the very back of a restaurant uh-huh. and you're like, oh, that's the girl in purple boots. Uh-huh. And she's the only one wearing color like that.
Yeah.
And so she stands out and she draws your attention.
Yeah. There are these very strange. I remember thinking, I hate those boots, but it's also like they stand out.
Yeah.
And there's something almost weirdly poetic about them. And yeah, there's so many shots in this where I'm just like, what? Like, I think for me, the standout shot is when the girl is having a fantasy that she's marrying this rock star.
Yeah, that's like the one that when that movie came out, everyone was like, how did they even do that?
Because it looks like they're in a house and then all of a sudden the house starts moving. And I was like, oh, they're in a train. But then no, like it pulls into somewhere and then a crowd of people outside rush to their house. It's a house.
And this is all in one shot.
Yes.
So like it just starts taking place inside this room in this house in the kitchen mm-hmm. and they're just having a two person scene mm-hmm. and there's nothing to indicate that they're on anything besides inside a normal room.
Yeah.
Except outside the window, like 45 seconds into the scene, yeah. you start realizing things are flying past. Like, yeah.
And
moving.
I was like, no fucking way. And I was like, I guess they're on a train, but then it's just, no, it's a house. And then, cause don't they pull out to show more of it?
They eventually then cut to a reverse. So they're on the train station.
Yeah, you see them
and
in the house.
A full apartment building is on this train, and the full apartment building then pulls away.
Yeah.
And so you don't see a train at all. You just see an apartment building going down these tracks.
That was so wonderful to watch.
Yeah.
And I was reading that apparently the director got the idea for the shot when he was a kid. He saw a bunch of buildings on logs being rolled.
Oh.
Yeah, they were moving buildings, literally. And so he's, as a kid, to see a bunch of buildings literally moving away, I mean, I guess that really struck him. And yeah, it was just like this wonderful, surreal image. And I think it was towards the end, but, well, I can find out right now. Yeah, it is towards the end. I think for me, I enjoyed watching this, but what I had trouble with is that, I think when you're watching a bunch of vignettes, at some point you expect, oh, this is all going to tie in together. I don't know if it really did.
But I also don't know if it's the point of this type of movie.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's also, to me, it's more just almost like a slice of life. It's like a surreal slice of life.
Uh-huh.
And so you're just seeing all these different things happening. And that's also why like the title is so interesting. Like mm-hmm. You, the Living, mm-hmm. It's a very broad title.
Yeah.
It just encompasses, it'd be like calling the movie Life or mm-hmm. something. It just covers everything. So for everything to tie up in a neat little bow,
mm-hmm.
I feel like would be sending a message that everything is much neater mm-hmm. than it actually is. Like this movie is really trying to deal with the, like what I was saying before about the taboo, they're just like the messy parts that we mm-hmm. don't normally get to see on screen.
Yeah.
Like one scene that is coming to mind right now is that woman who's like, she's trying to get her mom to like remember her. Do you remember that?
When yes.
It's such a small moment and it doesn't tie into anything else.
Yeah.
But she's like, mom, tell us about when you were younger. Tell us when you were younger. And the mom just doesn't respond because she's like very ill or has Alzheimer's or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And, she just totally devolves and it's just like crying and as she just can't get her mother to remember any of the good times.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know at all who this woman is. So we're forced to kind of like value her perspective just because she's just a human person.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's no other story or backstory. We're forced to have empathy for all these people that we wouldn't normally mm-hmm. have empathy for.
Yeah, and they're all like fleeting moments.
Yeah.
Yeah. The title of this movie comes from not a lyric, but a stanza from one of Goethe's poems, which I don't have in front of me, but the gist of it is man is obsessed. The greatest obsession is man. And it starts off like you, the living, having a gusto for life, all before death kisses your foot.
Mm.
So it's just something about having a strong yearning combined with the inevitable traces of death.
It's the dream. It's like having these intense, passionate dreams in the face of inevitable not coming true, sort of. That's why the girl with the purple boots having that dream about marrying this rock star, she meets him once in a bar.
Yeah.
And that's like their only interaction. She spends the rest of the movie just popping up every once in a while, like screaming out in over the town, being like, where are you?
Yeah.
You know, like, I want to see you.
Yeah.
And then she has this beautiful dream of them getting married, and you just yearn for this girl, and you're just like, you want all these people to be doing a little bit better than they are.
The person I connected with weirdly, which might say a lot about me, is the woman who's dressed in leopard, who's older.
Oh yeah.
And she's literally like in tears. She appears a couple of times. She's always in tears. And she's like, no one understands me. She breaks up with a guy, and he's there. They have a dog, and he's like, this is your dog. She's like, take the fucking dog. You know, and gets me. And you see her later with her family, and she's like, mom, you're a sadist. You're torturing me. You're serving non-alcoholic beer. And, she appears again a third time. I'm trying to remember what, but I don't think she finds she's just in pieces because she can't find someone that, oh no, she does end up, oh, the guy that she breaks up with keeps coming back. And she's just like, go get away from me. She's like, I might change my mind later though.
Yeah. I'll see you at dinner.
Yeah.
Brisket in the oven, right?
Yeah. She's like, if there's dinner later, I might come by. And he's just like, this is his average day. Oh, weird little side note. Mm-hmm. Did you notice the guy that she breaks up with? He has a bunch of tattoos, and one of them is an SS tattoo.
No, I didn't see that. There's another in the tablecloth scene when he pulls the tablecloth off the table. There's a big swastika on the table, which is like such a weird moment.
There's another scene where there's last call at a bar, and people rush to the bar, and one of them is a girl who specifically has a neo-Nazi haircut.
Yeah.
And I was just like, this is strange.
There's a lot of like Nazi and war imagery that I think he's, and obviously the end when the bomber planes come.
God.
But there's in some of his, so his two other movies that are in this series are, the first one is called Songs from the Second Floor.
Uh-huh.
And then the most recent one, which is the one that a lot of people have heard of, even though You the Living is kind of considered like the masterpiece of the three. They're all three of them are incredible. But the most recent one is A Pigeon Sat on a Branch Contemplating Existence, which came out a couple of years ago. And people just remember that because the title is so absurd.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of war imagery. I think in one of them, like two people are getting lunch, and then like outside of the restaurant, like a modern restaurant, an entire like military army comes by for like 5 minutes, and like people on horses come into the bar and they ask for like a glass of milk, and then they continue marching. It's just like there's a lot of war imagery.
And it's so, because the usage of the imagery, it didn't feel political. Like these, like the people with the Nazi imagery on them, they were all they weren't doing anything Nazi-esque. Because the guy with the SS tattoo, he wasn't doing anything. He was just getting broken up with. He was, if anything, he was the nice boyfriend. And then the girl with the shaved head with the sides thing, she was just getting last call. And I was like,
well, those are also the contradictions in this movie. It's like
The
really nice guy who we feel empathy for. Mm-hmm. We also see the SS tattoo.
Yeah, and it was a big one, and it stood out to me. And I was like, whoa, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm. It kind of makes you ask, like, can both these things be true?
Yeah, and but the thing is, like, it's not like, oh, he doesn't know what these means. Because there's a scene where in a barbershop where a guy's being racist to his barber, being like, you guys read from backwards anyway, so make sure you don't cut my hair backwards. And the guy punishes him by buzzing him right in the middle.
Such a slapstick kind of bit.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And what was funny is the next scene, like, you see the guy getting mad and chasing the barber to a coffee shop where the guy's really calm. He's just like, I'm having a bad day.
Mm-hmm.
it's weirdly... Yeah, so you feel justified why he did that, but it's all at the same time, it's not political, and I don't know, like it felt very
I don't think it's very it's sort of a lot of this movie is just presenting things, mm-hmm. right? Even going back to what we were saying about the editing or lack of editing mm-hmm. style, it's less about making a judgment, like a directorial judgment by deciding where I'm going to frame this, where I'm going to cut. Those are all like directorial decisions. Instead, he's just kind of like shining a light on something, keeping mm-hmm. it super still. So even though the director is having a lot of like subtle ways of controlling where the audience is looking, mm-hmm. it kind of makes you feel like there actually is no judgment. And then it's just like, here's a slice of life. We're not even going to put any edits in there. Mm-hmm. And now the audience feels like they have to engage even more because they're the ones who are choosing what to look at. Mm-hmm. There's multiple jokes happening at once. So you have to kind of like choose where you're going to put your eye.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was hard watching this because I was trying to take notes, but also still watch because yeah. there was stuff
a lot going on.
Yeah. Like there's a scene where a guy, these businessmen are having coffee and you slowly see him in the background getting pickpocketed.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah. Like the guy sitting next to him, like reaches into his coat and just grabs his wallet and you see it slowly happen. And
he's being so arrogant. He's like bragging about how much money he has.
Yeah. Like they just closed a business deal and this guy's like, they're having celebratory drinks and he's just like, we're fucking rich. Da, 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 da. And then you just see him slowly getting robbed. And I'm like, this is insane. This is so insane.
And, but I love that all of that's happening in mm-hmm. one shot.
Yeah.
You know,
cause
it's almost like the old, like Charlie Chaplin movies or something where mm-hmm. you just have like very basic setup. The actors were all required to do it as if they were on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there's a stunt, like it's, you're seeing everything about it happen. Mm-hmm. Like if there's a comedy bit, you can't rely on the editing to make it happen. Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing I wanted to ask you about is I've been thinking about this movie recently because I've been directing something for the first time, like directing a short film for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been thinking about how to balance that kind of style of comedy versus drama.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost wonder if some of the actors in this movie aren't even actors.
Well, here's the thing. I was reading about him. A majority of them are non-actors.
Right. It had to be because he casts these people that are just so weird sometimes, like just the way they look, mm-hmm. that it'd be very impressive if they were affecting that. Like if they were putting that weirdness on.
Yeah.
I think he just goes through his life, Roy Anderson probably, and just finds really interesting people. And it's like, you fit the tone that I imagine. I'm just going to put you here. And just by you sitting there and like saying a couple words and like your voice is a lot higher than we're expecting it to be based on like your mustache or you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Any small thing like that.
Yeah.
Is just instantly funny. Based on like nothing.
Well, what's so interesting is like when I read that he cast a lot of non-actors, I was like, that's really impressive because everyone does a great job.
Mm-hmm.
Like no one felt like bad because right before this, I recorded an episode with Tony Rodriguez where we talk about a John Waters film, Multiple Maniacs, and there's a lot of bad acting in that and it's distracting and it's kind of throughout. And I'm just like, how do you go from there's that side and then there's this side where you cast a bunch of non-actors, but they're all stellar.
Well, but I think part of it is, I haven't seen Multiple Maniacs, but one thing that I think he does so well is he writes a script that's incredibly complex in its ideas,
mm-hmm.
but not that complex in terms of what it's requiring from the actors.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't, because there's not like arcs of characters or anything like that, or like, if a character breaks down crying, they're like obviously fake crying.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not, you know, it's a surreal world. So it lets you get away with all this stuff.
Yeah.
So if someone's not a good actor, you can just use their not good actorness kind of for the benefit of the comedy of the movie. It's a lot of people just kind of like standing around looking really dry, looking really bored,
uh-huh.
not almost uncomfortable in front of the camera.
Yeah.
But he's able to use that comedically
mm-hmm.
instead of letting it point out that these people don't know what they're doing.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I guess that background in commercial directing, he must be really apt at like casting. Shooting around people.
Yeah. Yes. It was similar with commercials. It's like most commercials don't require
acting.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't need to be Philip Seymour Hoffman to do those commercials.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, there's its own kind of art to it, but so much of the art of commercials making is in the casting of it.
Yeah.
Because you're casting someone who just evokes something
yeah.
for a viewer, within the first like 10 seconds of seeing them, mm-hmm. Whether that person's like a downtrodden businessman or like a working class person who is aspirational or mm-hmm. a crook or whatever. If you kind of get that vibe from someone right away, you can then either undercut that by having them play like the opposite of what they look like, which ends up being funny, mm-hmm. or let that person be kind of like a stereotypical business person yeah. so that the event that happens around them, like getting his head shaved, yeah. makes him look even more like a buffoon.
Yeah. Yeah. He looked amazing with his head shaved. Like he, well, not completely shaved when it first gets buzzed, like he legit looked like a toy. It was amazing. And, what was weird, not weird, but so interesting is that afterwards, the next scene, you see that same character, like with a fully just buzzed head in a meeting. But the thing is, the scene's not about him at all.
No.
And I'm like, it's so weird to try and watch him as a neutral person when I saw him be an asshole in the previous scene.
Yeah. But isn't that great? Like, I just love yeah. that yeah. because it's like, you know, you get to know someone's backstory.
Yeah.
Even though they're not the centerpiece yeah. of this particular scene.
Yeah.
And in that scene, for the first like 3 minutes of the scene, you know, a lot of the scenes in this movie, if you just describe them, they sound boring because it yeah. sounds like nothing happens. Like the first yeah. 3 minutes of that scene is literally a bunch of people introducing themselves at a business meeting.
Yeah.
But it's so funny because it's so mundane. Mm-hmm. Like the introductions are just like, you just hear the same person say his name over and over to every person. And yeah. you're just like, oh my God, business is devastatingly boring.
Yeah.
Like that is just what yeah. they're kind of saying with that scene. And then the like CEO has a heart attack, like out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh, like everything's boring until something catastrophic happens.
Yeah.
And it could happen at any time.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was just, yeah, the mundaneness of life and, it's just so, it almost feels like, I'm like, is this what it's like when God watches people?
Yeah, where it's just a lot of like brushing your teeth.
And yeah, like, yeah. And then it's just like, let's just like, all right, holy shit, okay.
That's another thing that you rarely see in movies. It's just like the mundane,
mm-hmm.
Because it's boring. It's like really hard to make it engaging.
Mm-hmm.
But this movie does a really good job mm-hmm. of treating the mundane as something kind of like celebration worthy.
Yeah, like a weird little iconic moment.
Or like the guy playing the drums. Mm-hmm. Like he's just practicing by himself to like a tiny little tape recorder.
Yeah.
And all he has to do as his drum part is just bum, 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 yeah. bum. But it's yeah. so boring.
Yeah.
But he's like practicing it with so much focus mm-hmm. that you can tell like he loves this. This is his extracurricular activity outside yeah. of his like work life.
Yeah.
He loves this. And then you see him at a rehearsal and then you yeah. see him actually do the performance.
Yeah.
And then you see the performance is more something that we recognize because we've yeah. seen like marching bands,
uh-huh.
but we don't realize the mundane practice that mm-hmm. had to go on in order for this marching band to take shape.
Yeah.
And so we appreciate the whole of the marching band because we've seen the incredibly mundane practice
yeah.
that had to go on behind the scenes.
And the weird amount of passion that went into this thing that you're only glancing at.
Yeah.
So I think this is definitely an indie darling. Dan, you definitely do because you recommended
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I love this movie. I this is one of the movies that when I meet people who are like big film buffs,
mm-hmm.
It's one of like the first five movies I always recommend to people because a lot of people haven't seen it.
Mm-hmm. I've never even heard of it.
Yeah, a lot of people haven't heard of it. But like, if you like this movie, there's also two more kind of like it. So
well,
it's
yeah,
it's
the second one in a series of three.
Yeah, and it's just so funny and so serious at the same time. So it has a little something for everyone.
You saw the other two movies that are in this series. Do you feel like those are crucial watches too?
I think they're crucial watches just because they're just so good. I mean, like this director is just an incredible director and no one else makes movies mm-hmm. that look even remotely like his movies. Like his style is so singular.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're listening to this, obviously you're interested in these type of movies, then I would say, yeah, you got to go see those three.
Do you think that you need to watch because this is the second one. Should people watch the first one before?
I don't think the order is really that important.
The order
they're definitely
matter.
Like distinct
yeah.
movies,
yeah.
but the thing that links them is sort of the themes
uh-huh.
and also maybe some of the actors,
uh-huh.
But the style, like
yeah.
this sort of like pale face, like sets
yeah.
kind of style
uh-huh.
is I think the main link, but I watched him in, I think, You the Living, Pigeon, Songs from a Second.
Mm-hmm.
So I did it all out of order.
Okay.
And, you know, it's great.
Yeah. Aside from those two, because obviously it's a series, what other films would you recommend if someone was interested in this?
Okay, so the two other movies that I also recommend all the time to people, one of them's called Holy Motors. Have you seen Holy Motors?
No, that sounds familiar though.
Okay, so this is a movie that came out a couple of years ago. It's a French movie.
Uh-huh.
Also is sort of told like vignettes. And there's one character that basically, the premise of the movie is basically there's this guy who is sort of an actor, but in this world, the cameras have become so small that there are no cameras. And so this actor's job is to go from situation to situation in life and just play a character in these different people's lives. And you just follow him as he does his makeup transformations and he goes into all these different vignettes. And this main guy's performance is one of the most like just mind blowing performances you'll ever see. Cause he plays like 12 different characters. It's so good. And it plays with so many different styles and genres. And it's very, there's a lot of like weird, surreal French stuff in it. It's so
that sounds good. Like a dream for an actor.
Oh my God. It's like an incredible dream role. And it's sort of about acting.
Yeah.
And he plays like, he does everything in this movie. It's just
it almost sounds like that movie, The Truman Show, but from the viewpoint of one of the actors within The Truman Show.
Yeah, it is a little bit. There's an element of that. And then he kind of like finishes his role.
Uh-huh.
And then just goes back into his car and goes on to the next role. It's a very, very bizarre movie.
That's so amazing. Yeah. I have to check that out.
Definitely recommend that one. And then the other one I recommend is just from a couple of years ago, Tony Erdmann. It was nominated for Best Foreign Film, I think maybe 2 years ago, in like 2015 or 16.
Mm-hmm.
It's a German movie, and they're remaking it right now with Kristen Wiig and Jack Nicholson.
Oh my God.
But the original one is, the reason that it reminds me of this one is the balance of comedy and the drama. Like it's incredibly dry.
Yeah.
It's about the kind of like high-powered business world, but essentially the log line of it is like, there's this woman who has this dad who is a real practical joker, but the daughter is trying to be a very serious business person.
Yeah.
And so she keeps pushing the dad out of her life.
Uh-huh.
But in order to try to connect with his daughter, the dad shows up at her business meeting, like a business trip, as some fake character named Tony Erdmann, and just ingratiates himself into her life and takes on this role, takes on this character.
Whoa.
And it's so funny and so like sad at the same time.
Uh-huh.
It's just a beautiful movie.
I can't help but notice the movies that you chose are both something that would seem like a dream role for an actor. For those of you that don't know, Dan is a very accomplished actor himself. So I just thought that was interesting from a psychological standpoint.
Well, I think a lot of times, like the two big things that I look for when I'm watching, especially these kinds of like indie movies, is like indie movies allow for much more complicated storytelling and complicated roles for actors. So a lot of the times the best performances you're going to see are in these really out there movies because they don't care about making money in the same way that the bigger budget movies need to make money to make back their budget.
Yeah.
And the same thing in foreign films where in foreign films, there's just more of a art for art's sake mentality.
Yeah. Also they have, you become very aware that there's different types of storytelling when you watch a foreign film.
Yeah.
Like you think you know what a narrative is supposed to be. And then I was very lucky when I was a kid, I grew up watching foreign films because my mom loved watching foreign films.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh crap, we don't have to follow such a strict narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Like beginning, middle, end, like, oh, you can have flashbacks or you can have a murky ending.
Mm-hmm.
And you could have an ambiguous main character. There's no rules.
And independent filmmaking allows you to take those risks.
Mm-hmm.
That's the biggest thing that I like about indie films is that it allows you to take huge swings because there's so much less at stake in terms of money.
Yeah, because what's so interesting is about every single indie film is a passion project.
Yes.
No one was forced to make it. Someone went broke trying to make this.
Right.
And I'm just like, I had like good or bad. I really do after because I made an indie film. You were in it and I paid for it myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so like my hat goes off to anyone who's ever made an indie film because I'm like, you get it. And good or bad, I'm just like, bravo. It's such a fucking effort.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of one of the reasons why I wanted to start this podcast because like I feel like these almost take more effort and as opposed to like big budget studio films, but these get such less, like it's hard to find reviews on stuff like that I'm interested in. Like there's a bunch of films like I would love to Because these also have the more complex stories. And I'm like, I need to talk to someone about this. And I'm like, there's like two reviews online.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's another reason why I wanted to start this podcast.
It's good you bring more attention to these things.
Yeah.
There's an amazing Philip Seymour Hoffman quote that I think after he won the Oscar for Capote, he was doing the like press thing afterward. Yeah. And they asked him just like, he was talking about acting, but I think it applies to indie filmmaking too. They asked him, do you have any advice for actors? And he took this really long pause as he was sort of thinking it over. And then he said, if you ever get a chance to even go into an audition, if someone spent the money to rent out that room and someone spent the time to sit there and watch you act, then you owe it to yourself to give every single thing that you have to this. Like, take every risk that you ever wanted to take, bring all of yourself to this performance. And if you can do that, whether it's good or bad or whatever, whether you're right for it or not, there's no way the person watching it will ever forget it. Because if you can give all of your passion to something and take risks, you can't tear your eyes away. And that's what the potential is for indie filmmaking, where you'll see people take these huge swings and these big risks, so much passion, and just making it with grit instead of just with money. And you kind of can't look away at its best, you know?
Yeah, even,
best, you can't look away.
Even bad indie films, I'm like, I'm never going to forget this.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, because I watch a lot of movies and the stuff that stands out, I'm like, that was, you know, the most interesting choices.
Yeah. You want to see something you've never seen before.
Yeah.
You know, and that's inherently risky.
Mm-hmm. Well, that about wraps up our show. Dan, is there anything you'd like to plug?
You can follow me on Twitter. It's at Daniel Ammerman, A-M-E-R-M-A-N. Mm-hmm. And then I'm also in an indie movie that's on Netflix right now. It's called Face to Face with the number 2. It's a little bit of an indie movie for like teenage audiences, because it's for a younger crowd. But I think it does take some risks in it, in the way that the story's told and things like that. So I think that if you're sort of a younger listener, it almost in a weird way could be a good intro into a little bit of a riskier indie budget type thing, but for a younger viewer.
Awesome. And that about wraps it up for this episode of Indie Darlings. And if you want to learn more about indie films, or if you like what you heard, you can give us a review or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, right? And shoot us an email at theindiedarlingspodcast@gmail.com. And that's about it for now.
Bye, Connie.
Bye.
Amanda Salvatore.
And I'm Jackie Ray Arbell, and we are the hosts of
Guilty Pleasure, the podcast that celebrates, elaborates, and experiences our odd interests.
We talk with comedians, writers, and artists about their chosen guilty pleasure, like LARPing, Burning Man, Keanu Reeves, Allen Iverson, television shows, 60s and 70s rock and roll, and the list basically goes on and on and on.
If you'd like to check us out, we have a new episode every single Monday.
Delivered to you from Campfire Media. Find us on iTunes or anywhere that you get your podcasts.
Thanks for listening.
Hey, thanks for listening.
Campfire.